Sunil just demonstrated why he won that 2017 MacArthur Prize. Thank you for a very thought-provoking talk, Sunil, and I'm sure there's many questions from the floor. I'll abuse my privilege just briefly. But I've got one question for you, and that is, you very clearly sketched out a tradition of kind of technocratic modernism for water management in India, the Bhakra Dam speech is perhaps the most famous, economic development. But then my attention was drawn in particular to your picture of the overlay of seismic zones and dams. And actually, Dan Haynes a while ago gave a little presentation that had something similar. And it drew my attention to that map is also a map of security issues for South Asia, right? You mentioned, of course, that Adivasis and Untouchables being disproportionately affected by displacement, which makes me wonder, you know, how does that feed into state insecurity domestically along the frontiers and the borders? Not even talking about geopolitics, who's going to control the Brahmaputra or the Indus waters. That the art of governing water is intimately linked with the art of governing the hills. And so I wonder if you might comment on a third area that you hinted at in your talk that didn't fully explore, and that is perhaps the security, or securitization of water management.
And that's a vitally important dimension of this. One thing that strikes me is really how late in the 20th century the hills came to be the focus of this sort of water engineering. And partly I think that relates specifically, precisely to your question, that it's only as both Beijing and Delhi have sought to assert themselves in these frontier areas that this infrastructure is part and parcel of that establishing the presence of the state. I mean, road building usually precedes down building in almost every one of these places. I think, you know, in many ways, the Chinese instance of the post-1980s proliferation of dams in Tibet is perhaps even a better example than the Indian one that I've given today of how close the security, governability, governance, and water management are concerned. I mean, there's no question that the frontiers of water engineering in this entire region are also regions which central governments have the most tenuous hold over, which are regions where local populations often feel disenfranchised, often feel alienated from exactly those kinds of nation-building, modernizing projects which from the 20th century on provide a kind of ideological motivation for this kind of
that. Let's open it to the floor. I'd invite questions. My only request would be if you can identify yourself before you ask a question. Yes.
Hello. My name is Mindy Sinfoga. I'm a senior double major in history and international affairs. My question is sort of related to the question that Dr. Hopkins asked. You mentioned that dams in India are a symbol of progress and modernity, and also that indigenous peoples and scheduled tribes tend to be disproportionately affected by these. I was wondering if you thought there was some sort of connection between the fact that internal development programs in India conceptualize Adivasi as sort of backwards populations and antithetical to progress as related to the fact that there are the people who are most easily displaced and most vulnerable by the because of these symbols of progress.
I think you put it more eloquently than I could, and I think that's exactly one of the reasons why they have been disproportionately affected is because they're states' view of them as obstacles to progress is something that's rooted in the colonial era, but which really doesn't change very much after Indian independence. And in a sense, there are many scholars and Adivasi activists who almost writing sort of new internal colonialism that goes on after 1947 in terms of the state's approach to those communities. So there's that, but there's also the fact that, of course, the Adivasis' lifestyles and livelihoods depend on forests. And it is those forests that are both economically valuable, but also precisely where these dams are to be built to make way for a different kind of agrarian landscape and for a different kind of industrial. But I think that the ideology behind it is important. You know, we're asking the question, but why are they not heard? Why does it take until the 1970s or 1980s for there to be large-scale protests against these kinds of displacements? But I think a lot of that has to do with voice, a lot of that has to do with inequalities of power. It has to do with precisely that. I think Nehru says in the late 1940s, the very first group of people who are displaced, I think it was for the Hiraku Dam in Orissa, if you want to suffer, at least you suffer for the nation. And I think that that mentality is still current, that these are necessary costs for progress. But perhaps the question that isn't asked so much is, well, progress for whom and who, you know, who's benefiting from this, and who is, are certain groups disproportionately bearing those costs?
I'm Linda Yar here at the Seeker Center. You mentioned that the two engineers went to the Mekong River Commission. So as you know, there is quite a pushback of civil society throughout Southeast Asia, the International Rivers Network, any number of organizations in Thailand, Vietnam, and elsewhere. To what extent do you see a connection between civil society, you know, anti-movements in Southeast Asia and in South Asia?
It's a wonderful question, and something that's sort of very close to my heart in terms of that's one aspect of the story I'm continuing to delve into. I think there are lots of connections, and they actually go back to the 1970s. One of the interesting things about this publication and other publications in this group, the Center for Science and Environment in Delhi, their first publication was called The Citizens' Report on the State of the Indian Environment, and it was published in 1982. And there's a very short preface which says something that I find profoundly interesting, which is that the inspiration for that report actually came from Malaysia, and that it was actually by going to Penang, which in the 70s was a real center of consumer activism, which by the late 70s had turned into consumer slash environmental activism, that they got the idea, because apparently Consumers Association of Penang, CAP, had in the late 70s published a citizen's report on the state of Malaysia's environment, focusing particularly on deforestation, on how the Orang Asli, the tribal peoples of Malaysia, were being impacted by some of these development schemes. The same network around Penang, it morphs into something called the Third World Network in the 1980s. They're the ones who published Vandana Shiva's first book. I mean, Vandana Shiva becomes perhaps the best-known Indian environmentalist in the 80s and 90s, spokesperson for the anti-globalization movement. And in fact, she's also first published out of Malaysia, out of these networks that I think really are really important in the 1980s and 90s. I don't know the contemporary situation so well, but I would imagine that those links are as strong as they've ever been, if not more so. I suspect that through the 2000s, that these kinds of networks between civil society groups that are trying to come together to see a shared problem would only increase.
Deepa, lovely, from the Seeker Center as well. Sunil, let me sketch out a possible alternative scenario to the securitization of water. Mm-hmm. And I will, I may suggest that when you look at the China-India area that focused on the Himalayas, one of the things that comes up is, of course, the Tibetan water tower, where all these rivers are in fact flowing from the headwaters. But then when you look beyond the India-China and go further into Pakistan as well as Bangladesh, India is the mid-right territory. So the point is that when you look at relationships among these countries, geopolitical relationships, because that's what I look at. The idea that somehow China, being the ultimate sort of control, being having ultimate water, and so if there's, you know, dam building that constrains water to India, it's also constrained to Pakistan and Bangladesh, who happen to be very good friends of China. So there is, I see a more complex set of relationships that then perhaps technical and political coming together where they'll have to sort of sort it out in a way that it could be an area of cooperation rather than competition. What do you, how do you see that
prospect? I mean, I think the role of Nepal and Bhutan, for example, is sometimes neglected, but this is seen as an indigenous. In fact, both the Indians and the Chinese are heavily invested in dam construction in Nepal and Bhutan. And I think that it's precisely that level of complication that it certainly led me not to conclude in my book that geopolitical conflict is the only way this could work out. I mean, I know some people are very strongly of that view, but I think I really agree with you, and you know more about the geopolitics than I do, that there are such complicated relationships now. And obviously, there are also very important private sector interests involved. That's one way in which things are very different from the period I spent most of my talk talking about in the 50s and 60s, when this was all state-financed or World Bank-financed infrastructure development. I mean, now you have, of course, Chinese engineering companies play such a major role, not just in the region, in sub-Saharan Africa, but there are all sorts of private interests too. And so I think it's become a much more complicated scenario than simply thinking about it in this way.
Hi, my name is Kristen, and I'm 13, and I'm in art history. And I was particularly intrigued by your conclusion that the historical record provides us with sort of alternative tools to think about these problems, cultural history of water management. And so I was initially sort of thinking about certainly the way that water has been controlled and incorporated into architectural and sort of landscape spaces, but also the sort of symbolic power of water, and particularly that image you have of the Lincoln River Rose, mm-hmm. and I was thinking about river goddesses,
that's
and
true.
The wonderful depictions that we have from such an early period. Did you find, have you found in your research, thinking maybe about the 50s and 60s that you focused on, in what ways have the sort of the cultural power, the sort of sacred power of rivers, of these waterways, has that come to play in these kinds of conversations about dam building or not?
That's a wonderful question, Anna. What I'm struck by is that the sacred and spiritual power of the water is very evident in the 50s and 60s. And yet somehow completely disconnected from the conversation about dams, development in the future. It's not that one displaces the other, but it's that they're sort of... So my colleague, Diana Eck, who wrote that wonderful book, India, A Sacred Geography, I mean, a chapter on rivers ends with this question, how can the Ganga be the most revered and the most polluted river in the world? And she works through that, obviously, a clear answer. She works through that question. And so in the 50s, just when they're building these big dams, there's a massive movement around the 1950s, which the first after independence, which brings so many tens of millions of people to sort of converge precisely on the sort of sacred power of the river. Nehru, in his last will and testament, he writes in this sort of spiritual sense about the Ganga and about how he wishes his ashes to be buried there, not because he's religious, but because nevertheless it represents the continuity beneath history. But the same Nehru calls the dams the kind of temples of New India. There was this other side, there was this other vocabulary, there's this other way of thinking about water. Really, in everyday life, the sacred power of the waters means as much as any of these infrastructure projects do to a lot of people in their quotidian existence. And sometimes when these things clash with one another, as I think they started in the 1980s, that you see interesting ways of trying to address the relationship between the two. I think the place where that's happening is actually the Indian courts. So the National Green Tribunal of India has actually recognized sacred groves, the preservation of sacred groves, as falling under the freedom of worship of the Constitution. And there are ways in which even some decisions in the Indian Supreme Court have almost sort of personified nature in a way, not quite giving it rights in the way that some countries have moved towards doing, but nevertheless, they're bringing in these arguments about the spiritual and sacred value of these rivers. It, interestingly enough, it's in the courts post-1980s that you see that tension really coming to the fore.
Hi, my name is Harmony Gill. I'm a graduate student at my school. My question is about the river linking project. As you mentioned, it keeps getting revived and it's, you know, stopped in the British time. Why do you think it keeps getting that revival? I mean, BJP 2 under Modi in 2015 started it again, but faced a lot of opponent, like, faced a lot of opposition on it and sort of like stopped it in 2017, and it's more. It's been more active on Ganga, but not on Mount Puja. Why is that?
It really is an idea that just won't go away. I mean, it was there in the 1870s. There's a moment in the 1960s where they start talking about it again. And I think some of it is just this profound sense that India is so shaped by inequalities of water that it really does contain some of the wettest and some of the driest places on Earth. And that has clearly been something that's rankled in the minds, particularly of water engineers. Can't we fix this? I mean, I think there is that sense, starting around the late 19th, early 20th century, that, you know, the technology is there to do something about this. Mao makes the same comment in the 1950s. You know, he says, you know, so much river in the southern part of China, we need more in the north. It would be good if they could give us some. And, you know, the across the ideological spectrum, I think there's something profoundly attractive about this. I don't think it will ever happen, and one of the reasons is purely that, you know, we think we've talked a little today about water conflicts in a trans-border way, but there are profound water conflicts within India, and I think that is what, more than anything else, will stop a project like this going on. Look, the Kaveri dispute has been going on since, depending how you look at it, the 1920s or the 1950s. It continues to escalate at particular moments. It's by no means the only one. How the river linking project will be governed at a federal level is, I think, probably one of the reasons why it keeps running into trouble. Quite apart from the cost of it, which is estimated now to exceed $120 billion. And there are, of course, there are profound concerns about the environmental impact and about human rights, but even if those don't feature in the calculations of the government, I think there are these federal obstacles to this kind of project in India that are always going to slow down.
Just a question. When I was back in Chennai a few years ago, it seemed like there was a revolutionary rainwater collection technology that was really changing the face of the local water environment. It seemed that people were actually having water, poor people in particular, on a regular basis, whereas before they had to buy at a very dear price. Has it indeed changed things in Tamil Nadu? Has it changed things throughout India?
It has definitely not changed things throughout India. I think there are particular regions where there really has been a far greater sort of investment in energy into thinking about water housing. I think Tamil Nadu is one of them. Rajasthan is another. The journalist Meera Subramanian wrote one of the people called it Meera Rise Again, in which she investigated, and in a really sort of deep report, she investigated the revival of old water bodies in parts of Rajasthan, which didn't rely on these large technologies, but you know, neither is this about a kind of romantic return to a pre-colonial past. Some of these are very new technologies, but they're small-scale technologies, the technologies that really do sort of bring water to the poorest communities in ways that, you know, the large dams often haven't done. And I think that, you know, this is patchy, it's very concentrated. I think it has a lot to do with particular political cultures as well as particular hydraulic cultures. And Tamil Nadu has had powerful water activists since the 1990s who have been pushing in this kind of direction. They've got major public figures involved, including musicians and others, and there's a lot of awareness about these things. But there is also an infrastructure of tanks in Dalmar, which, you know, even if it was in decay, even if it had been neglected for a long time, some of which can be used, and I think you know some of them are the same in Rajasthan. But by and large, I mean, if you read the work of the architect and historian Anthony Achebati on the Ganga, it's not happening.
I wonder if I could get you back to actually your starting point when your colleague asked you about the history of the monsoons and what sort of history. And I look at the title, and you have Water in the Making in Modern India. And to be slightly provocative and pushback, you offered us a national history, in a way. And I wonder, what are the opportunities, but also the consequences of giving an ecological history within the national?
I'm not sure we really can. I mean, I think this is one of the things that I sort of gave this a particular frame, but in the work of project and in the book that this is from, it, one of the things that became within is you can't write this story with the national borders. Not least because the monsoon, not only does the monsoon as a climatic phenomenon disregard borders, but even if you look at the history of monsoon science more specifically, the story of monsoon science in the 20th century is the realization that in fact the monsoon is governed by the whole planet's climate, and that it's not something that can be limited to the Indian subcontinent as was felt in, say, the 1850s or the 1860s. Whether it's river pollution, whether it's air pollution and its effects on climate, as well as on human health, every single one of these is sort of regional, transnational sort of issue. And I suppose one of my challenges in starting this project in the first place is what would it mean? So those of us who work on area studies, which is a lot of people here, we are so concerned with regions, how regions come about, what binds them together, where their boundaries are, how flexible their boundaries are. What would happen if we sort of marry that area studies conception of regions with an ecologist? So one of the things that started me on this whole project was the fact that, you know, in the social sciences and the humanities, the old category monsoon Asia is not one that we use. It's one that colonial geographers used in the 1920s and 1930s, but it was classical. But that's still a phrase that is uncontroversially used by climate scientists. And so that, for me, was one of the things that got me thinking about the monsoon, national histories of the monsoon, and you know, how do you put together a sort of area studies perspective on this, with a focus on the fact that, you know, it is for a period in the 20th century national states that most try to sort of intervene to reshape the landscape of water, and yet this is always exceeding their boundaries.
I have a question about the politics of big dams. Like, when I think of the politics of irrigation in India, I think of the Green Revolution, you know, seeds, two wells, subsidies, and the farmers' movements in the 1980s and 1990s that led to a lot of that type of provisioning in the agricultural sector. Your talk portrays the politics of water as very top-down, very technocratic, and I'm wondering if there is at all a broader politics of what public sentiment is with respect to dams, and how do political parties have positions on dams beyond just the Adivasi issue?
I think there absolutely is a broader politics of water. I think it's a very divided politics of water. I mean, I think a lot of this does come down to, you know, who the groups that have benefited from these dams. And I think a lot of the sort of farmers' movements of the 1980s, 1990s were calling for more subsidies, for more tube wells, and I do, in a sense, they were beneficiaries of this. You know, on the other hand, you have the farmers' movements that in the more recent past have been generated in unirrigated parts of India, who maybe they want more irrigation. I mean, I don't think there's by any means a kind of blanket hostility to large dams coming from the ground up. It's not a story of kind of top-down imposition of dams. I think the opposition to dams is very specific and very fragmented. I mean, you have the environmental activists, you have those displaced by particular projects like the Narmada movement, which of course was huge at its peak, but in some sense sort of fizzled out, not least because some of its supporters probably found that the elements of the project might well have been in their interest. Water is not very often a major good for the platform, and you know, I think you will know as more than I do about, you know, perhaps why that is, but I very rarely see water issues on election manifestos, and certainly not on election campaigns. Water, like health, is in fact kind of both vital but often politically invisible. I don't think most political parties have a major position on. I think most of the major political parties are voting in favor of dams, except those who can make political capital out of a specific dam project, which is perhaps affecting their constituents. The politics of dams has also, I think, been the sort of interstate politics of dams. I think so. It's been a huge deal in Tamil and Tamil Nadu and Karnataka politics over the Kaveri River, over the particular plans that the other side might have for those river waters. So in that sense, there's a politics of dams that has to do with control, which has to do with state boundaries, with state interests, with state rights. So I think you could look at this from every level, from farmers' movements to the geopolitical, which would be some of the other questions that we've gestured towards. We have time for one more question.
Joshua Sessa, undergraduate history. So my question has to be strictly in the context of Pakistan and the taking time bomb of their water scarcity crisis. Are there any kind of lessons we can take away from what India is doing in how they're working on the preservation of water, and specifically from India, in how that might be something worthwhile in a broader context of the water region?
I think Pakistan's water crisis is, if anything, worse than India's. By various measures, the most water-stressed country in the world, or amongst them. Whether there are direct lessons from India and whether those lessons would be palatable is an open question, particularly given the rise in tension over the Indus just in recent months, the Indian threats to withdraw from the Indus Treaty for the second time in the last 4 or 5 years. I think there are conversations that are happening at other levels, going back to the earlier question. Indian and Pakistani environmental activists talk to each other. You know, I think they exchange information. There are forums, neither in India nor Pakistan, where they can actually share the fact that, you know, some of these are very much shared problems and that there might be solutions to them. There is a movement within Pakistan, particularly after the terrible floods of 2010. To think about the implications of climate change, to think about the implications of the particular water infrastructure that Pakistan has become so dependent on, and how it's in fact the intensely engineered landscape that made the floods so bad. And I think, you know, there is a movement within Pakistan, albeit on a small scale and at a local level, to think about perhaps other models. They may not come from India, I think there are probably many other places, they're just as likely to.
Well, I think that takes us to the end of this evening's formal program. Please join me in thanking Sunil for his insights and really provocative questions about water in South Asia.